Hello and welcome to this episode of the Beyond podcast and this continuing live recording of Middleton's Endgame, a game at chess day from the 400th anniversary of the staging of this infamous play by Thomas Middleton. Following an introduction and a performance of the play, we reached this, the first of two panels, covering what happened immediately after the play closed in 1624. If you haven't listened to parts 1 to 3 of this series of recordings from the day, I do suggest you go back for a bit of context, certainly at least episode 1. Otherwise, let me throw you back to Sunday the 8th of August, 2024, one of the 400th anniversaries for A Game at Chess by Thomas Middleton. This is The King's Gambit, and I hand you over to past Robert.
So, the game is over. The final performance on Saturday, 14th of August, 1624, of A Game at Chess is done. The jig, as they say, is up. Nine, or possibly more, performances played nearly non-stop for 10 days, and then the party came to an abrupt halt to discuss what the hell just happened. I am joined by Will Green, Tracy Hill and Daniel Yabbott to talk about The King's Gambit, as well as readers Keith Hill and Gillian Horgan. And let's be fair, everyone was talking about it. The Privy Council was finally nudged into action 4 days after the last performance. Chess plus four, if you will. On Wednesday, 18th of August, the Privy Council minuted
a warrant directed to Ralph Robinson, one of the messengers of His Majesty's chamber, to bring Middleton before their lordships to answer
for his terrible naughtiness. Meanwhile, the Spanish ambassador, Don Carlos Colomar, wrote home uncertain whether King James, despite his assurances, is genuinely going to punish the actors. So, panel, wonderful panel, what's going on with the king? Where the hell is the king? Will.
Well, it's a difficult question to answer because there's a lot to say about it.
Go forth, that's why we're here.
It's important to remember that for this play, it's putting James in personally and politically a very difficult position, because this is a man who, though he probably doesn't realise it, is coming to the end of his reign. He's becoming increasingly unpopular with his people. He's got this image of himself that he keeps wanting to put forward as a peacemaker. And the first thing he did as king was the 1604 peace with Spain, one of the earliest acts he takes, end that war with Spain. But that is a peace that was never universally popular. Events in the 1620s are making things ever worse for James. Where is he in his political life? We've had the Battle of White Mountain, which has led, it's part of the 30 Years' War, that's led to the exile of his daughter, Elizabeth Stuart, and yet he's maintaining this policy of non-intervention. Then the Spanish match is something that's really important to James, because he thinks that this will be a diplomatic route to solving all of these problems. He's trying to control the spread of news in England, because printed newspapers are becoming a thing that's very popular in the 1620s. He has this unpopular friendship with Gondomar, who many people in England see as the person who convinced him to have Sir Walter Raleigh executed in 1618. And now he's away on royal progress in the Midlands. It's the perfect time for people in England to put on a play that really is, it's encapsulating all of this anger and this unpopularity, I think, that James is suffering from.
Yes, I mean, this thing, he's been on the throne for quite a long time, and we've seen this before with other rulers, that after a while, you know, things just get stale. And all these little things come bubbling up underneath. Other thoughts on the panel?
There's been a kind of a rise in mutterings about military action on the continent as well for some years, so even in the Lord Mayor shows, actually, you get this sort of, you know, celebration of the military arm of the city and this kind of very, very thinly veiled talk about how important it is to have an army and to be prepared to take action. You know, Middleton's obviously in the middle of all that as well. So yeah, this is kind of building up big time. And so the player Middleton and the players absolutely, you know, risky though it was, timed it perfectly.
That's where the king's at. What's going down with the players? Thursday, 19th of August, chess plus five. Sir Francis Nethersole writes to Sir Dudley Carlton.
The players were yesterday called before some of the lords of the council who met here for that purpose, by whom they are forbidden to play any more at all till they may be licensed again by His Majesty, and must appear again at his return from his progress, for which they have put in bonds.
Friday, 20th of August, chess plus six. John Woolley, who we enjoyed so much earlier, to William Trumbull again.
The Spanish ambassador hath at last, though with much ado, got the players to be silenced and enter into bond not to play Gondomar or any other till they know His Majesty's farther pleasure. Middleton the poet is sought after, and it is supposed, shall be clapped in prison if he do not clear himself by the master of the revels, who allowed of it, and it is thought not without leave from the higher powers. I mean the prince and duke, if not from the king, for they were all loath to have it forbidden, and by report, laughed heartily at it.
Meanwhile, the ambassador to the Florentine already knows that the player has been prohibited by the Privy Council. The ambassador to the Venetians also knows all about it and also reports the news. So it's fair to say there's a ton of bricks heading towards the players. Thoughts on that panel? Who wants to leap in on players' attitudes to power? They're prodding the bear. It happens every so often.
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on something that Keith just read out. I think John Woolley absolutely nails it with the prince and the duke, higher powers. Actually, it's really funny. Yeah. We're good guys, so we're fine. I think that's a large part of it, really. James is kind of absent and, you know, probably increasingly absent. You know, and they take an opportunity to kind of establish a new political profile for themselves. It's kind of an interesting kind of duopoly with those two, which we haven't got time to go into, really. But obviously, the precedents of being clapped in prison are not numerous, but they would be remembered by the players. You know, it was only 1605 when these Woodhull playwrights were clapped into prison. And then 1619, there's a play that is toying with ideas, with events around the 30 Years' War, which is very controversial, with the Master of the Revels takes out John Barnfield and Oldenbittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittittitt
English accent, like Sir John Van Alden Barneveld.
That's the one, that's him. That's him. Yeah. But that was kind of, it was not okay, clearly, because, you know, George Buck did sort of insist that a certain person should be taken out. But it was more okay than Jess, because it wasn't actually about anybody important. So, you know, it wasn't about King or an ambassador.
Mm.
I know that we talked about it at the beginning, but just so, because we're throwing around a lot of names, just to clarify, so that the Spanish ambassador was Gondomar, who was the white, essentially the black knight in this play. So when we talk about Gondomar, it was from 16, somebody correct me if I'm wrong here, 1613 to 1622. And so when this play was licensed, I believe it was June 12th, 1624, Gondomar was no longer the Spanish ambassador. But he was still being talked about in the pamphlets and still being mocked. It was a new Spanish ambassador who wrote and complained. It was Colomar who was writing and complaining about this play going on. So it was no longer Gondomar who was. And I think that's important to say. And also when this play was staged, they possibly purposely made sure that James was not in town.
But I think the fact that it's called as a shorthand, the play of Gondomar, or just Gondomar, says everything really about, you know, the centrality of that character, the fact that everybody knew exactly who it was. And even though he hadn't actually had that position for a couple of years, it didn't really matter because he was the boo guy.
Yeah.
Mm, yes. I mean, we've had so many in the pre-show, we had all this stuff about, you know, his incredibly famous anal fistula. Everybody knew about that. That was a big laugh line, clearly, for the play that they were going to lean into, because he was a public figure. And it's this really interesting question about all these public figures that we'll come on to anon.
So when this play was being, before this play was being staged, there were a number of pamphlets going out against Gondomar. And one of them, I believe it's in your program, but for those looking, following from home online, it's called The Second Part of Vox Populi. And it actually has an engraving of Gondomar on it that is in the program. And then if you look at the title pages of A Game at Chess, the printed editions, it has appropriated that engraving for the play as well. So there's no mistake that the Black Knight is Gondomar here and that they're mocking him.
We're going to gather a little more data from letters from the time. Another day passes, Saturday, 21st of August, Chess Plus 7. The Privy Council writes to Sir Edward Conway.
We have called before us some of the principal actors and demanded of them by what license and authority they have presumed to act the same. In answer whereunto they produced a book, being an original and perfect copy thereof, as they affirmed, seen and allowed by Sir Henry Herbert, Knight Master of the Revels, under his own hand, and subscribed in the last page of the said book. We, demanding further whether there were no other parts or passages represented on the stage than those expressly contained in the book, they, confidently, protested they added or varied from the same nothing at all.
There is more on this note. We will have some defence of the players. One of the defence of the players is to blame the Master of the Revels. We'll come on to this question about who the Master of the Revels is in a moment. But the Privy Council are clearly not very impressed with the current master, Herbert, and the text of the play is to undergo some intense scrutiny.
As for our certifying to His Majesty what passages in the said comedy we should find to be offensive and scandalous, we have thought it our duties, for His Majesty's clearer information, to send herewithal the book itself, subscribed as aforesaid by the Master of the Revels, so that either yourself or some other whom His Majesty shall appoint to peruse the same may see the passages themselves out of the original, and call Sir Henry Herbert before you to know a reason of his licensing thereof, who, as we're given to understand, is now attending at court.
So, official censorship is something that was sort of crept up in the Elizabethan period, an official post Master of the Revels comes into being, which you effectively can buy into or sublet. The current Master of the Revels at the time of this play, Sir Henry Herbert, pays £150 a year for the privilege. But the great thing about that is, of course, he can extract money from players and other people for the licensing of plays. And, of course, he has to make his mark on anything that he has allowed to go through. And so when a controversial play goes through, this big question of, was it the play or was it the Master of the Revels? And, of course, the players are all going, oh, he licensed it, it's fine, Gov. And, of course, he's going, well, maybe the players did something else. Thoughts on well, censorship here?
Well, I mean, that's clearly throwing Herbert under the bus, which is, you know, quite funny, really. and also, the Privy Council, if they bought that line, that they performed it exactly as per the book, whatever book we're talking about, because, of course, there were multiple versions of the play, they didn't know how theatre works, because, come on, really? Sure about that. I'm going to look at it. Yeah, it's just the idea of them all sitting there poring over it, going, oh, what about that phrase? What's your record? What do you mean by that? It's hilarious. Anyway, so yeah, I think it's an intensely political position in the 1620s, the Master of Revels, in a way that it is only sporadically prior to that. I mean, there's Edmund Tilney had the post in the late 16th century. His kind of moment of fame was probably the Thomas More manuscript, the book of Thomas More, which was heavily censored. I'm not sure the date, 1692, 93, I think, anyway. And then the Barneveld play, which I mentioned earlier. So, but yeah, it's they're thrusting Herbert into the spotlight. And he is, of course, a courtier. So in a way, that's kind of, you know, you should expect that, really.
And we haven't had that many Master of the Revels. I mean, it's passed down a relatively few number of people. The previous one to Sir Henry, he's only been in the job for about 2 years because, to quote poor Sir George Buck, the previous incumbent Master of the Revels, is in old age fallen stark mad. So sadly, his previous censor underwent some infirmity in his later age and died very soon after. And that's the point when Herbert is doesn't actually gain it. He has to sublet it from the person who actually owns the position, Sir John Astley. It's this interesting thing. He's coming into this role. He's only been in it a few years. Do you get the impression that maybe they're trying to just get over the new guy?
Well, I think it's important that someone stands up for Herbert and points out that I think a lot of people might assume, you know, he is essentially a censor, and that is something that can be very much looked down upon, often with very good reason. But the Master of the Revels isn't really their enemy. And I think it's quite unfair to put on a play you know is inflammatory and then try to throw Herbert under the bus like that, because the Master of the Revels isn't outright banning plays. That happens very rarely. This is someone who's saying, you've submitted this to me, now, so for your own safeties as well, these are some changes I would advise you to make. Here's some cuts, here's some rewrites. Sometimes it might be extreme, you might get a play like Massinger's Believers You List, where it's like, put it in ancient Rome instead, because otherwise it'll look like it's contemporary events. But he works with the players. So I do think that this shows a general us and them attitude in a way with the players that isn't really justified. It's harsh on Herbert. It is harsh.
It's hard to know really where he stood, because he was only, I think it was, 1 or 2 years in the job. Mm. Just to clarify, when we talk about the book, when a play is written, it might be in several forms, but one of them has to be submitted to the Master of the Revels, and the master at this time is Henry Herbert, needs to put his seal of approval on the final page, saying this book is good to go. There's a few books that are still surviving where you'll actually see, I think, George Buck and Bonnevelt in 1618, in the manuscript copy of that, actually says, I do not like this portion of it. The famous example that Tracy had talked about, Sir Thomas More, which has 5 or 6 playwrights in it, it has passages marked out throughout. So the manuscript looks very, very messy. That might end up being the book that is done. That's not to say, however, that changes may not happen afterwards, and whether or not the Master of the Revels actually has to see it again is up for debate, because we only have actually one license on this play, and as we'll talk about, there are several versions of this text.
Mm. Yeah.
So when it was licensed, but surely there were versions afterwards.
Yes. At what point does a play change enough for it to be worth? Because of course it costs money to go through that process. So it might be a case of there is an understanding that okay, there are a lot of tricks and a lot of things going on. It's reminded me very much, talking about it now, the kind of censorship position we had with film in say the 1950s with films like Coming Through Hammer or similar, where they are in active negotiation with the censor, saying we submit the script in advance, and the censor says no, you can't do that. That's not going to work. And of course, they then try to game the system by adding things they know won't get through and hoping that the other lesser stuff might survive. Yeah. So I wonder if there is a relationship situation here.
There is an interesting situation where I can't remember the date, so don't ask me. But there is a play, which I won't name, because it will go against the Beyond Podcast rules, that would...
not only that, against your contract, yeah.
But there is an example of the King's Men going to the Master of the Revels and saying, we'd like to revive this play, we've lost the allowed book, can we put it on, or do we need to get it relicensed? And the Master says, as long as you haven't added anything, yeah, it's fine. So there's an element of trust there, I think. I mean, how many years ago was a play performed? Who's going to remember? There's an element of, okay, yeah, as long as you're not adding anything and you tell me you're not, then sure. There's an element of like, I trust you guys, come on.
And we mentioned in the setting up the board, More Dissemblers Besides Women, which was a revived play which he saw again and made his comment that it was the worst play ever written. And so there does seem to be a question of how long and the relationship, and maybe as a new censor, he was just looking at everything. Master of the Revels, yes, we should be careful of that term. It is a dangerous, invidious term. Let us gain some more. We have a sense of the failure in the Revels office, or maybe not the failure in the Revels office, as we've discussed. There's also a question of the author and the players.
The poet, they tell us, is one Middleton. who, shifting out of the way and not attending the board with the rest, as was expected, we have given warrant to a messenger for the apprehending of him. To those that were before us, we gave a round and sharp reproof, making them sensible of His Majesty's high displeasure herein, giving them strict charge and command that they presume not to act the said comedy any more, nor that they suffer any play or interlude whatsoever to be acted by them or any of their company until His Majesty's pleasure be further known.
So, fairly comprehensive shutting down of activities there from the Privy Council. So, throughout all this, what's Middleton doing?
Well, this one has a quite short answer. Middleton has gone to ground. I can't say that he's fully gone to seed, but he's gone to ground. He's apparently very difficult to track down. He's quite wily, which is something I quite like about him. I like to think he's still... Maybe he's been emboldened by the player's roaring success and he feels that, well, yes, he's got this trouble, but the audience might be on side because so many different texts of this play survive. And, you know, Daniel's going to talk about that more later, but I wouldn't be surprised if he's, you know, he's thinking, well, we're going to get this sent to you, you're going to do this, and we keep working, getting this play disseminated in some way.
I've been doing this stuff for 20 years and suddenly I'm famous.
Exactly.
Leaping to Dan briefly on this point, that during this period, or certainly during the play's run, I don't know if immediately afterwards there's evidence for this, but manuscript copies of this play are being copied out and being distributed, some in Middleton's own hand, or at least partially. Dan, do you want to briefly talk on those that sort of action going on here?
I'll introduce it now and then get into it a little bit more later. But when we talk about the surviving editions of texts, they might come down either in print or in manuscript. Sometimes you only have one printed edition. When I talk about editions versus copies, unique editions, I mean typically a quarto. When I say a quarto, that's a format. This is one leaf, and if you fold it one time in half, and then you fold it another time in half, you're going to get four leaves, but eight sides or eight pages. So that's what I talk about when I speak about quartos. So Game of Chess was printed in... there were three different editions of this in quarto. You might only get one edition of a play in text. Game of Chess is also unique because there's also six different manuscript copies out there in multiple hands, including in Middleton's hand there. And so when we talk about the issue with the book, the licensed book, none of those surviving editions are the one that was licensed by the Master of the Revels. But what's unique and what's exciting to me about this play is that some of these editions, not only being in Middleton's hand, were also being copied out during the time that the play was actually being staged, or at least are dated to that time period. So you actually get to follow a little bit the evolution of this text here, which is why we keep talking about, well, is this the play that was licensed by the Master of the Revels, or did they add stuff on like they do in legislative bills? We're going to Christmas tree the bill, and then there's just too much there, so we're just going to let it pass and just trust that you're doing the right thing here.
And the fact that it's being copied speaks also to the scandal, and we shouldn't forget how much this scandal flew through society and how it appeared to two witnesses of it. So still on Saturday, Chess Plus Seven. John Chamberlain writes to Sir Dudley Carleton.
I doubt not, but you've heard of our famous play of Gondomar, which has been followed with extraordinary concourse and frequented by all sorts of people, old and young, rich and poor, masters and servants, papists and Puritans, wise men, etc., churchmen and statesmen, as Sir Henry Wotton, Sir Albert Morton, Sir Benjamin Rudyer, Sir Thomas Lake, and a world besides. The Lady Smith would have gone if she could have persuaded me to go with her. I'm not so sore nor severe but that I would willingly have attended her, but I could not sit so long, for we must have been there before 1 o'clock at furthest to find any room. They counterfeited his person to the life, with all his graces and faces, and had gotten, they say, a cast suit of his apparel for the purpose, with his litter, wherein the world says lacked nothing but a couple of asses to carry it. and Sir G. Peter, or Sir T. Matthew, to bear him company. But the worst is, in playing him, they played somebody else, for which they are forbidden to play that or any other play till the king's pleasure be further known. And they may be glad if they can so escape scot-free. The wonder lasted but 9 days, for so long they played it.
So the biggest loss for us, we were just discussing this as modern viewers, is what it actually looks like on stage. This is such useful information for us, this letter, is that the impersonation factor. What were the actors doing with it? Rather than what they were saying, which obviously we have some idea of, but actually what they physically looked like. They've gone, in theory, to the detail of making them look visually like the person that may have been on the streets a few years earlier. There was a letter written on the last day of the show by the Florentine ambassador talking about how Gondomar and the bishop are presented, fistula and all. So, and this fistula, it's so important to this play. Anyone who's ever felt discomfort sitting in a theatre for a long period of time. There was personation, and there were clearly more successful caricatures than others. Panel, anyone want to leap in on that?
I think what Keith was doing was just kind of very sort of under, ouch. That was probably a good guess, beyond the chair. And I'm very disappointed in having a commode. I'm sorry. I'm so disappointed. Beyond the chair thing, I think that was just a reminder, a visual reminder that this is Gondomar and we all know about him. Other than that, some of them are a bit splatter, obviously, is the other one who's very kind of clearly exaggerated caricature and so on. But some of the others, just you wouldn't really know. I mean, there's a debate about who the White Queen is.
Which one is Spilato, just for the...
The Fat Bishop.
Right, just to let... Yes.
Sorry, yeah.
Yes. Spilato is the Fat Bishop.
Yeah. Mm.
And it's very clear that it's the Fat Bishop.
Yeah, because it very much mirrors his coming into the country and also fleeing the country with as much stuff as he can take with him. All of those references are very, very clearly tied to what we know about his biography. So.
I mean, you can see from the way that Liza performed it, it's an absolute standout role as well. I mean, I know you're sceptical about it, Rob, but I think it... I thought it was brilliant.
I'm not sceptical about it, with this as a separate discussion. this is the last. That will be the last panel today.
Okay.
I do think, though, that a lot of time, there are obviously these standout roles, like you say, but it's also important to note that a lot of the humour in the play, a lot of the characterisations and the caricatures, apart from the big roles, you would be okay just getting away with Spaniard performed. Because Spaniards were really subjects of mockery by a lot of people, to the extent that often they were considered a distinct race, like not wholly European in a way. And I actually think one of the best things I've made a note of here is Orazio Bassino's, who was the chaplain to the Venetian ambassador. Mm. He had this to say about an impersonation in Middleton's 1617 show, The Triumphs of Honour and Industry, which we know that Gondomar actually attended. And he says of the play that this Spanish character comes on stage and the gestures of his nation were expertly mimicked with small black mustachios and a cape after the Spanish fashion, continually blowing kisses to the onlookers. So there's so much way you could either be someone who's really into your current affairs and be able to think, I know what that character's referencing, I know who that's meant to be, or you could still enjoy it on the level of, I don't like the Spanish, and they're making fun of the Spanish. And I'm making that distinction with the White House, the English characters. I think it's just very interesting to think about how those caricatures worked as well.
And I think I'm so glad you mentioned that, so many different reasons, but 1617 is before the kind of, 30 Years' War really gets going on the continent. So it's a kind of interesting sort of bridging moment, where it's a very long time since the Armada that really never goes away.
But Middleton hasn't forgotten the Armada.
neither has anybody else. I mean, the follow-on from that passage that you just read out was this somebody being pelted with fetid mud.
Yeah.
And nearly kind of disrobed and taken on by the horde. So, yeah, there's a lot of... There's stuff.
Yes, and this is probably a good point for me to bring up the two lines we cut from the play. And we cut it because we just cut the Black Duke, because the Black Duke is pointless. In terms of as a text, I suspect there was something very much different going on there, because when the Black Duke gets put in the bag, the line of dialogue that the White Duke says about him is, "Room for a sunburnt, tansy-faced beloved, an olive-coloured Ganymede." So when we're talking about the nature of the personation going on in this play, perhaps more so with the more peripheral characters who may be just there to be, it's like the Black King, the Black Duke, they're not necessarily really characters, they're people saying lines and doing moustache twirling. In a way that Gondomar and the Bishop of Salato are clearly figures who some characterization has gone into in the text and potentially also in the performance.
There's another interest, speaking about those cut lines that you cut, there's another question of darker skin being associated with villainy and how that was performed. And one thing that always stands out to me is the title page of the 1615 quarto of Thomas Kyd's The Spanish Tragedy, where all of the characters on that title page are from the Iberian Peninsula. But the villain, Lorenzo, is the only figure who is presented with a black face. So that does make you think that, is it more than just words, or did skin painting play a huge part in communicating villainy of these Spanish characters and these impersonations?
It links in with the Egyptian thing that you mentioned earlier on, but also there's the Ganymede thing and Buckingham. I mean, come on. And you know, then on that little scene, the little kind of bridging scene that you described it as earlier on, you know, with the kind of riffing on Birking and stuff, like, that's another element to the play, I think, in terms of its sort of satirical intent, which is very close to the bone, even after all these years. I mean, it's only 4 years before Buckingham gets assassinated.
And this is, I think, a point about the way satire functions. I think sometimes we get caught in this idea of saying, this figure is this figure, this figure represents this figure. And some of the characters, that's clearly straightforwardly done. But the thing about satire is you will fit little gobbets of data in amongst the text all over it. So it may not be that individual figures specifically supposed to be Buckingham, but there may be many bits of Buckingham all over the text that the play is doing. I wrote a satirical thing a few years back in my youth. There was only one one figure being satirized. I may have killed him six times during the course of the show. And this is the thing, it's not like one figure was being, there was only one figure being satirized, but he was being satirized in various different ways. And I suspect for the original audience, there are so many other little hits that we're missing in both, being what was being personated and also what was being said.
I think it's always dangerous to try to do to direct attribution to things. It's like when people try to do authorship studies and say, hey, you know what, this must be the author's intentions right here. It's like, well, part of it's play, possibly some of it's based on what the author's life is like, and lots of it's probably fictional and based on other people that you know in your life. We were at, Rob and I were, and Tracy was there too, at the Deptford conference on Christopher Marlowe about a month ago. And there's a scholar named Todd Bullock who did a paper on traps that were used in early modern texts. And what was striking to me in reading my character, I think you should just look it up right now because I couldn't remember who I was comparing. But I was talking about the fat bishop being like a blind mole, and then talk about how it's a verminous, it's building up this hill only to get trapped later on. And what Todd had brought up was in The Jew of Malta, and often during that play with Barabbas, if you're familiar with The Jew of Malta by Christopher Marlowe, he is being compared to a mole as well. And if you know how the traps were actually conceived, it is really, really horrid and how they are. And it's very much in detail of how the traps were made, how they were going to catch this Jew there, and then also the look of the mole. So it's striking to me here that they're using the mole comparison here for the fat bishop as well. But these are all things, you know, we talk about the morality plays of the 1570s and earlier. It's hard to attribute to say who the actual vice character is, but I think there's a couple who are good candidates for it. And so all of these things, the black, the depiction of the mole, the Egyptian, all of those things are coded in early modern period of these are things that you don't like and stay away from them.
Yes, and especially talking about a mole trap, which is literally they're going to fall into a bag, they're going to fall into a trap. And that yes, when you were doing it on stage just now, I had exactly the same reference of going, that was such a good catch. We're going to move on from this question of personation. It's clearly an issue. But nearly a week passes before we get any more fun stuff to read out to you. And at the court in Woodstock on Friday, 27th of August, Chess Plus 13, Sir Edward Conway, Secretary of State, writes to the Privy Council.
His Majesty's pleasure is that your lordships examine by whose direction and application the personating of Gondomar and others was done. And that being found out, that party or parties to be severely punished, His Majesty being unwilling, for one's sake and only fault, to punish the innocent or utterly to ruin the company. The discovery on what party His Majesty's justice is properly and duly to fall, and your execution of it, and the accompt to be returned thereof, His Majesty leaves to your sound care.
Also on Friday, the Earl of Pembroke writes to the President of the Council, Viscount Mandeville.
Complaint being made unto His Majesty against the company of his comedians for acting publicly a play known by the name of A Game at Chess, requiring them to covent those his comedians before them, and to take such course with them for this offence as might give best satisfaction to the Spanish ambassador and to their own honours. After examination, that honourable board thought fit not only to interdict them the playing of that play, but of any other also, until His Majesty should give way unto them. And for their obedience hereunto, they were bound in £300 bonds. As for this, the game at chess, that it be not only antiquated and silenced, but the players bound as formerly they were, and in that point only never to act it again. Yet, notwithstanding that my lordships proceed in their disquisition to find out the original root of this offence, whether it sprang from the poet, players, or both, and to certify His Majesty accordingly.
So, there's a host of decisions being very, very firmly made at the court. These, of course, all immediately leak to the Venetian ambassador, etc., on the same day. So we've got definitely lots of witnesses to... And they're all broadly agreeing to what decisions have been made about this. £300 bonds, interdiction from playing any play, and never, I love the term, antiquated and silenced, never to perform chess again. So, how much of that actually happens?
I think that's actually... I don't think it's that severe, really. I mean, not performing again anything is kind of, ooh, that's a bit of a blow. But, you know, they've already performed it for the play for 9 days and made apparently £300 million. So, you know, I'm just thinking again about Eastwood Ho, you know, and you know, they wound up in the tower. This is a slap on the wrist in comparison, really, actually. It sounds more like, you know, guys, you've embarrassed us. Can you just stop it for a bit, you know? And then we'll all just forget about it. And a bond is a bond. You don't have to pay it, obviously, unless you contravene something.
Yeah, because clearly everybody liked the play, with a few exceptions.
Including Charles and Buckingham.
And so, yeah, and that's the question, you know, within the court, because, of course, effectively we have courts, plural, in the sense that there is an uneven distribution of power shifting. It's a question of how much James is against it, but also, more importantly, how embarrassed is James? And we had in an earlier letter the point that, you know, they played the king. You don't do that.
No, you don't do that.
Will, I think, did you have something there?
I was just going to say on that I agree that it is quite lenient. And going again to Eastwood Ho, this was a play where the threat was... to its authors, we're going to have your nostrils and ears slit as a result of that for 2 lines of dialogue. And yet here's a play where the king himself was performed on stage. It doesn't seem too bad. I mean, if you were acting that, you'd think, guys, I think we got away with that.
Yes.
and the point is they will do it again because there's a lost play from December 1624, so we're only talking about a few months later, The Spanish Viceroy, which might have been by Philip Massinger. which has a much more severe reprimand from Sir Henry Herbert, because at that point the King's men decided, you know what, let's put on another Spanish play, but let's not even ask the Master of the Revels this time, let's just perform it. And then all that survives from that is a record of a really grovelling letter. You just say, we acknowledge that we offended and we'll never do it again, kind of thing. But, you know, considering, I mean, if you have a punishment like this for a play like A Game at Chess, you're going to try your luck again, because things did not go too badly.
Yeah, and actually, let's put it this way. The actors get a holiday. The early modern playing schedule is brutal.
Yeah.
And, you know, they get a month off. And they've got a lot of cash. And, you know, who's banking that? Where is that money now?
Resting in my account. Sorry.
Somebody who knows money can talk about early modern money, can talk about this better than I can. But what's estimated is that there might have been more than one performance per day. That's what some of the accounts say. And during those 9 days, we're talking August 5th to August 14th, Sunday being accepted because it was against the law to perform on Sunday. But it's typically said, one account says that it cost a penny to get into the theater, and it was a penny, like the cost of a loaf of bread, is that right?
Yeah.
They were talking about takings between 100 and 300 pounds a day. So, and the Globe is estimated to hold about 3,000 people. So they're talking about 15,000 possibly that they took away from this. Yeah. So, and also the other thing, I find it very hard to believe that when there's so much anti-Spanish pamphlets going on around this time period, and Henry Herbert had licensed this play, that all of a sudden they just said, oh, actually, no, this is really offensive. It's like, no, actually, I think they probably were for it beforehand until that Spanish ambassador complained about it several times. And then they said, oh, wait a minute, no, you can't do that. Yeah, you can't, but thanks for doing it. In fact, we licensed it. Mm.
And just for context, obviously converting to present-day currency is difficult when you're also converting from pounds, shilling and pence, but that £1,500, 9 days, you're talking about £200,000 for 9 days' work in today's money.
And that's very heavy money. I mean, that's a physical, physical substance.
Yeah.
Saturday, 28th of August, Chess plus 14 days. John Woolley again to William Trumbull.
Some say, how true it is I know not, that the players are gone to the court to act the game at chess before the king, which doth much trouble the Spanish ambassador.
So, 14 days afterwards, we have this potential performance before the king. Do we label this under gossip? Did the king get a private showing of the play? Is this performance 10 or 11 or 12, depending on how many matinees they squeezed in a morning? Thoughts?
Well, they say all legends have a grain of truth in them. Can we know? I would say that this has to be gossip, but where did the gossip come from? It could be a truth that has become gossip. I would say that something must have happened to change the player's fortunes, just because we're talking less than 3 weeks since we get that record of the players being told never to perform again until they are proved to do so by the king himself. And then 3 weeks after that is said, we get a record of the king's men again playing a lost play on the 6th of September called The Bee by William Rowley, who played the fat bishop in A Game at Chess. So that seems like quite a quick turnaround. So I wonder whether this has potential to have happened. Mm. Something like, well, show me what you actually perform, because so far, you know, I'm King James, I've heard about this from the Spanish ambassador, I want to see it for myself. And then you can actually make an informed judgment of, okay, maybe he was overreacting, or maybe they've learned their lesson, or some kind of deal.
I wouldn't be surprised if there's some Charles stuff going on in the background as well. Yeah. You know?
Mm. Charles
mobilizing.
Would love to have something. It's weird to think that the king who got beheaded is the one who was like the people's darling at some point in history.
I still miss Henry. Anyway.
I think, you know, considering we've read quite a lot of John Woolley over the course of today, as actually he seems to have been corroborated by a fair number of other accounts of some of his, you know, maybe the details are wrong. Maybe it wasn't to the king. Maybe it was just to Charles. I'm sure Charles of Buckingham would have had a swell old time. But yeah, I'm
after having read so much of his text today, I'm actually now more leaning towards that, actually.
I could just see Buckingham jumping up on stage, showing off his famous legs, you know, and just like riding around like, it's me, I'm wet, it's me.
But actually, that's interesting to say, because Middleton and Rowley had done the world tossed at tennis in 1620, which was, it was called a courtly masque, but doesn't seem to have been performed at court, but does seem to have been performed privately at the behest of Prince Charles, because it's very pro-Charles. So, yeah, a performance at court could definitely have happened. I could definitely see Charles organising something along those lines. It's just the kind of thing he would have done.
Yeah.
So, 2 days later, on Monday, 30th of August, chess plus 16 days, the Privy Council minutes.
A warrant directed to Robert Gough, one of the messengers of His Majesty's chamber, to bring one Middleton, son to Middleton the poet, before their lordships to answer.
And also we have this.
This day, Edward Middleton of London, gentlemen, being formally sent for warrant from the board, tendered his appearance, which for his indemnity is here entered into the Register of Council Causes. Nevertheless, he is enjoined to attend the board till he be discharged by order from their lordships.
So a Middleton's been sent for. They found one of them. What's going on here?
They're holding
him to ransom. We found Middleton. Thomas? No, we found his son. Well, that, we'll ask him instead then. I mean, it's like they're making do. We've got Edward Middleton. Do you know where your dad is? That must have been some part of that interrogation must have been, do you know where your dad is? Can you bring him to us?
Yes, exactly.
So time passes. You know, the Bishop of Spoleto dies in September 1624. So and nothing to do with the play. He just happened to do that. The following year, 1625, King James dies, and the play, which had been circulating in manuscript, now appears in print. And in the printing of the play, there were pictorial frontispieces, as mentioned by Dan earlier. And to label that picture, there is the picture plainly explained after the manner of the chess play.
A game of chess is here displayed between the black and white house mate, wherein crown-thirsting policy for the black house by fallacy to the white king check often gives, and to some straits him thereby drives. The fat black bishop helps also with faithless heart to give the blow. Yet maugre all their craft at length, the white knight with wondrous strength and circumspective prudency gives checkmate by discovery to the black knight. And so at last the game thus won, the black house cast into the bag, and therein shut, find all their plumes and coxcombs cut. Plain dealing thus, by wisdom's guide, defeats the cheats of craft and pride.
So let's talk briefly about the afterlife in print and in manuscript. I'd say panel, but Dan.
All right. So, it's very unusual to have this many unique editions of, as I mentioned earlier, of a play text that still survive today. As I mentioned, and you, if you have your programs, or there are also famous editions, especially during the pandemic, the fat bishop is saying, keep your distance. And so people were using this as a, yeah, wear your mask type of thing. But the manuscripts exist. There's six of them. I actually got interested in this play because in 2015, I was over at the Folger Shakespeare Library and somebody was doing a presentation on this play, and me just being an actor was like, hey, I'll do whatever you want on it. The Folger Library has four unique editions there. One of them is named after an Irish antiquarian named Mervyn Archdoll, so we refer to it as the Archdoll manuscript there. Now, we don't know exactly, well, we do know exactly when it's dated on the title page. It's actually dated August 10th. 1624. So that would have been smack dab in the middle of this 9-day run there. It's also exceptional because in that specific text, the fat bishop and the fat bishop's pawn are not present at all. And in fact, the black bishop is there. And later when the fat bishop is added, and we will say added, and I'll explain why, he has taken some of the black bishop's lines later on in the play. And how do we know this? It's because if you remember Rob, who is playing the black knight's pawn, the Gelda, is actually asking for absolution, and then he's being advised to go see the black bishop. And in the early edition of Archdol, it's the black bishop he sees. But that text has not changed in the later editions, but instead, it's Liza, the fat bishop, who's actually helping out in there. So that's one clue to the idea that, no, this is probably not just cutting out the fat bishop, the fat bishop's pawn. That was something that was added later on. All of the other nine editions, I'll say nine, but there's actually eight unique editions because the second quarto, printed in 1625, is just a mere reprint of the first one. So just to talk briefly about the editions, Archdol is an important copy because it's, even though it is in the hand of a professional scribe named Ralph Crane, we use that text to use for the basis of modern text today, in addition to the two manuscripts that include completely or partially Thomas Middleton's hand. Why? Because it dates to an early conception of the play. So we know, hey, at first, Middleton didn't necessarily have this fat bishop in mind here. So when we have holes in those manuscript texts, we're going to go to the Archdol text there. It's also exceptional because it also includes some of Thomas Middleton's corrections in there. So, and for example, there's a reference to the Temple Bar that is later like corrected to Drury Lane. And we said Drury Lane in the play, but it says Temple Bar there. I doubt it's the one in Dublin. Maybe it is. Ralph Crane is exceptional because he's known today as the scribe to the King's Men. He didn't only do theatrical plays, but he also did a lot of poetry, a lot of stuff on ships, on maritime pamphlets. Ralph Crane's work exists in many other, not just for Thomas Middleton, but many other forms. And we can even detect, because of his orthographical preferences, when they used a Ralph Crane manuscript to print a text out. For example, H-A apostrophe S, if you see that in text, in print, and you see it throughout, it's possibly based on a Ralph Crane transcript. It's important to say this because when we talk about the book does not necessarily need to be in the playwright's hand, the author's hand. It can be any copy that can be presented to the master of the revels that is going to be licensed as the book. Ralph Crane himself did serve as the bookkeeper, as in the one who, once the book is licensed, he then copies out the actor's parts and then distributes them to the players. So he has a very, very important role. So once the book is licensed, you're not necessarily supposed to make major changes because now the actors have their parts. It has been also documented that the actors will sometimes get their parts before it's been licensed, which can be a problem. So that's the Archdol text. There's another manuscript text called the Rosenbach text, named for the, I can't remember why, who. He was an antiquarian as well, because he's from Philadelphia, I believe. It's in two unknown scribal hands, nothing really significant about it. Other than that, the Folger also has quarto two, based on the reprint of quarto one, and that would be this engraving. This was printed afterwards, after the manuscript. This engraving that I'm talking about, for those following at home, has the depiction of eight of the players, the White House and the Black House, playing at a board of chess. And on the bottom has the fat bishop saying, keep your distance, while they're depicting essentially act three, scene one, where the Black Knight is approaching him saying, hey, I've got a letter from the Pope. It's a forged letter. And it also conflates Act 5, Scene 3, when the White Duke is right. He's like, checkmate by discovery. He's like, found them out there. So that's there. And then also quarto 3 is existence at the Folger. And that's based off of a Ralph Crane manuscript because of the orthographical preferences. As far as the other manuscripts, at Trinity College, Cambridge, they've got one completely in Thomas Middleton's hand. One might think, yes, you can access it online. It's all in digital. Or you can go over there, and they're very lovely over there. It's missing some text, about 80 some lines, actually. So that doesn't make it completely reliable. Luckily, we also have a partially holograph, autograph manuscript by Thomas Middleton at the Huntington Library in Pasadena. partially because there's two other scribes that do some certain scenes. Middleton's done one scene as well as the final eight leaves of it. So that's the other basis, primary basis for the text that we have here today. Quickly, the Bodleian's got a shortened version that has Thomas Middleton's dedication on it, Ralph Crane as well. But British Library has another Ralph Crane manuscript. It's missing the jesting pawn scene, as Robert said, that interlude where you've got the pawn. That's not in there, as well as not in the Bodleian text there. I think I've covered all the copies there.
So, yes. And we have, for this show, it is a composite text. It is primarily a maximalist version. And we've been reading for all of the 400 anniversaries of this play online on Zoom, slightly different versions. Not really fully going and digging into the nature of all of the different texts, but we have looked at something closer to an earlier form without the Fat Bishop to see how it ran, and we still have another three of these to go on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesdays. The sign-up form is still available on the website. Anyone wants to join us? But this for this performance, we as we went through rehearsals, one-to-one rehearsals with all the cast, I was basically sitting there with as many different versions as I could get my grubby little mitts on, and was going, okay, you can say this or you can say that. You can have that line or that line. So we were doing textual variants and basically deciding what the actor preferred in terms of choices. So it's not like we presented a specific text. It is a composite text that we produced for this. We are coming to the end of this little panel. The story of the performances only survive now with us in the various texts, but also other remembrances that are connected with the text. So here's an inscription found in a copy of the second quarto, printed in 1625, the owner of which noting,
after 9 days, wherein I have heard some of the actors say they took £1,500, the Spanish faction being prevalent got it suppressed, the chief actors and the poet master Thomas Middleton that writ it committed to prison, where he lay some time, and at last got out, upon this petition presented to King James. A harmless game, coined only for delight, was played betwixt the black house and the white house won, yet still the black doth brag they had the power to put me in the bag. Use but your royal hand, 'twill set me free, 'tis but removing of a man that's me.
So this is a witness to a bit of verse that supposedly Middleton wrote to ask forgiveness. And with these questions of forgiveness, we will go around the panel for any final thoughts. Dan, do you have any final thoughts to throw in? We're obviously all returning to discuss the play in greater detail after our next sequence. But Dan, any final thoughts here?
It was great to see this actually being read out and staged, because it's a play that I've been looking at for about 9-10 years, and I couldn't get my head around the names of the pieces and who they all were doing, and still trouble for me to do so. I love the idea as an actor having all of these options for texts, because it does also throw out the idea that, oh, you've got one text, you must be working off of this, and it must be by the author. Because as I've said, there's so many editions, and Middleton himself was changing his mind on making choices whilst he was copying it out. It was his text, or he's writing his name on the title page, so obviously it was all right by him. So when we as actors hear about, well, that's not what the actual text said, I'm like, are you sure of that? Because it could have gone through many, many different forms there. And so when I look at an early modern text, hey, I'm going to look at the spelling, I'm going to look at the punctuation, I'm going to make those decisions myself and see if it works better. And if not, I'll just follow the modern text there.
Will?
I think it was, again, yeah, like Daniel said, great to see this performed, because you get a much better sense of the scandal and the controversy behind this play if you can see it performed than you do reading it in a modern edition. But one thing that I just keep thinking about this play and its aftermath is this play really feeds into a narrative at the time that was telling people that James is in many ways a weak ruler. And I think it's so interesting what people are saying after the play is suppressed, because the thing that keeps coming back is the Spanish ambassador has got the play suppressed. So, you know, by taking so long to do anything about it, and then having the play suppressed after so many complaints, it just feeds into this idea of James obeying the Spanish. And having this whole experience of the play and all the readings around it just makes you realise, yeah, I mean, this play really does not do the king any favours. Didn't do Middleton any favours in the end either. But, you know, there's so much scandal here, and it's just a play that needs to be put on stage more, because it's just a lot of fun, and there's a lot of scandal behind it that's just... Oh, it's amazing.
This is Middleton's last play, but it is not his last performed work, which we will be doing in a moment. Tracy, any final thoughts that may happen to happily segue into our next sequence?
Everyone dies. basically, because... Well, sorry, that's facetious, as it should be, because it's a facetious play. 1625, not good, really, you know... very interesting echoes of 1603. Monarch dies, and everyone dies of plague. And there's no civic pageantry. There's not an awful lot going on in the middle and latter part of the year because of plague. So, yeah, it's kind of a strange sort of bookending of Middleton's career, I think. You know, he starts off with civic pageantry in 1603-4. That was postponed for a year. And then he ends in 1626, and then he dies himself. I'm still not over it. I'm sorry. 47. I mean, come on. Mundick carried on till he was nearly 70. Jesus. So, yeah, it's... Where could he go from there, really? You know, and he set out his stall in 1623, Lord Mayor's show, really, in terms of what he thought about Spanish Match, and, like, no surprises there, really. You know, Middleton was very much of the white party, clearly. And, yeah, we don't know why he died, what he died of, sadly.
A broken heart,
that might be it, yeah. Yeah, but this is, those of you, please stick around. Those of you who come to hear the 1626 done, it's kind of short and slightly elegiac, really. And I think that's kind of quite moving, really, in a way. Not just in a testament to the people that Middleton acknowledges at the start of the text, who had, you know, had died in large numbers in 1625, but also his own failing powers, his failing sort of position as a writer in the public realm.
Or possibly that what we've got is a thwarted rebirth. I mean, you think that in 1625 he was down to do Charles's royal entry, but of course that doesn't happen because of plague. He's doing a Lord Mayor's show. Maybe he's writing another play. Maybe he's starting to get work again. And then sadly, his career ends there. On which cheerful note, we will be performing our little reconstruction of the 1626 Lord Mayor's show, Middleton's last performed work, after our next break. It'll be about 15 minutes. We'll start at 6:30 for that. Thank you very much. See you in a bit.
The next episode covering the event follows soon, as we dive into Middleton's last performed text, the 1626 Lord Mayor's show. Till then, there is a host of other material on the podcast and YouTube channel. So many readings of the play in different cuts, depending on your interest, all available for free. There's also a discussion on Middleton's legacy on the pod, with the editors of a collection on that subject. Supporting us on any level on the Patreon is a huge help, so it will be lovely to see you there. There's a free subscription tier to keep up to speed with developments. Alternatively, you can support us on ko-fi.com/beyondshakespeare. Links to all these are in the show description. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.